Welcome to Breaking News with Ben Hunt, Jack Forehand, and Matt Ziegler. Before we start, let me remind you what the show is not. Breaking News is not a show about fact-checking. Breaking News is not a show about saying whose bias is the one and only correct bias. And Breaking News is definitely not a show about calling out fake news. Breaking News is a show where we look at today's top stories and have a conversation around our favorite critical question, why am I reading this now? Drawing on the headlines we're tracking at fiatnews.com, join us as we talk about what's collectively making us tick with clear eyes, full hearts, and this obligatory disclaimer. Nothing in this podcast is advising you to buy or sell any security or to do anything with your money. Seriously, you should only act on investment advice from someone you know and someone who knows your unique situation. We are not that person.
Welcome to Breaking News. I'm Matt Ziegler, joined as always by Jack Forehand, and here's Ben Hunt too. Say hello, kids.
Hello, kids.
Good to be back.
All right, so we have reduced sections today, but more bang for your buck. We've got a tweet of the week, or should I say tweets of the week, plural, on Biden, Musk, and the reasons for the treasons. We've got a cultish corner. We're going to talk about Netflix's The Greatest Night in Pop. Not going to confess how many times I've watched this since it's come out. But first, big picture. We're talking financial nihilism, Travis Kling's epic piece and tweet thread live now on Epsilon Theory. And let's start. This one hit all of us, and we all said breaking news all over this piece. Ben, why don't you start us off? What does Travis say when he defines financial nihilism?
You know, I think he gives credit where credit is appropriately due, which is Dimitri Kofinas, his podcast.
Dimitri's hidden, guy. Hidden Forces, yeah.
Yeah, Hidden Forces.
Wonderful, wonderful podcast.
One wonderful podcast, really enjoy that a lot. And it means, my take, exactly what you think it means, which is the YOLO attitude that we're, if you're a younger person, if you're a non-boomer in America, the avenues to that American dream, whatever that means to you, maybe it means home ownership, maybe it means making a lot of money, whatever that dream means to you, it ain't there. So what have you got left? Well, you got to put it all on red, or better yet, no, put it all in red's only a 2-to-1 bet. You've got a parlay.
Oh man.
You got to make a parlay bet. You got to string 5 out of the money wild ass bets together in order to create one bet that has a huge payoff. Because that's the only way you're going to break out of a cycle of despair and defeat. That's financial nihilism, and it gets reflected in shit coins. That's Travis's point. That's Travis's point. It gets reflected in 0-day to expiry options. It gets reflected in the Moas Diamond Hands crew slinging around options on Robinhood. It gets reflected in gambling sites where it's the parlays that have taken off, the in-game bets, the crazy exotics. That's how it gets reflected. Anyway, that's what it is. And it hit me so hard because I've actually written a good bit about this. I call it the speculation layer, which is not nearly as catchy as Dimitri's financial nihilism. But what I mean by the speculation layer is I'm using that word layer in the same way you talk about it in computing terms, right? You've got a database layer. You've got an operating system layer. The speculation layer is part of our fabric, our social fabric today. It just wasn't true 20 years ago. Where everything is a bet. Everything. And man, that's different in our world. So for me, it connects with what we talked about the other week. They are dopamine machines, smartphones. It connects with betting on everything. It connects with policy. It connects with narrative and stories, because we're told all the time, particularly non-boomers, that the only way to get ahead is that you're basically fucked. So you might as well just, you know, find some, you know, 16 parlay and, you know, good luck with that. It all comes together. That's why I think it's such an important topic that resonates with all of us.
He had a great chart on the parlays. Like the number of parlays people are, you know, doing in betting is way up. And, you know, for people who aren't familiar with it, a parlay is a thing where multiple things have to happen for you to win. So it's not a high probability bet. So it's a good example of like a more extreme form of gambling, and people are doing it more and more and more.
Yeah, that to me was the exhibit that really connected here, because apparently certain states, their gambling regulation boards, they break down not just gambling revenue, the handle is how much money is bet. That's the handle. And then how much money do the gambling operators make? And they break it down by type of bets. And what was amazing to me is how the dramatic increase in handle and winnings for the house parlay bets are today. And because it is multiple bets strung together, there's a lot more leeway for the house to price those bets in a way that gives them an advantage. And that's exactly what you see in the data here.
Can you say more on that side for me as somebody who doesn't fully understand this aspect of it? Can you explain a little bit more of the house's side in this thing? So we're not talking about the bet takers per se. We're talking about the house that's facilitating this. Talk me through their logic and how they price these fun adventures.
See if I can give a better example.
And I think what I'm trying to do is like differentiate this from the state selling scratch-off lottery tickets. So why is betting on this stuff different than scratchy lottos? Or is it not at all?
It's not at all.
Thank you. Tell me why.
Those are similarly very house odds-oriented gambles, bets that you can make, the lottery ticket or the sports bet. The difference is, there is a patina, there is a veneer of, oh, if you're smart, you can figure out the sports bets. Right? This is why the sports bets are even more popular than lottery tickets, because lottery ticket, we all know that that's luck. It's a lottery ticket. It's just luck. Sports bets, everyone who participates in the sports bets, they participate because they think they're going to win. They're going to win. And the reason there is such an embedded edge for the house is the same reason there's an embedded edge for the house. If you go to the, I'll use horse racing as an example. Maybe that marks me as a boomer. I don't know. Does anybody ever even do horse racing anymore? But horse racing is pari-mutuel betting. What does that mean? It means there's a pool of money, and the odds are assigned by the track. So if you bet on, you know, Lucky to win, and he's listed at 3-1, you get what he says. You get, for every dollar you bet, you get $3 back. Now, if you add up all the odds, let's say you bet to win. Let's say you bet every horse to win. It's not flat, right? There's a portion there that's taken off. The odds don't reflect an edge that's built in for the house. If you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's exactly the same way if you're betting, you know, what they would call money odds on a football game. money odds means you're gonna make money that this team wins or this team loses. And there's a payoff associated with that. You bet $100 on team X to win, you get so much money back if they in fact wins. If you bet, and because there's always odds, so let's say team X is the favorite to win. So I bet $100 to win on the favorite. I'm going to get something like $80 back. My $100 that I bet plus $80. So I'm going to bet $100 to win $180. Now, let's say I'm going to bet not on the favorite, but on the underdog. There, I'm going to bet $100 on the underdog to win. Now, if it was totally flat, I'd get back $120. That way that, you know, we've got two people each betting $100 on the game. If we're totally flat odds, then, you know, the person betting on the favorite would get $180 back. The person betting on the underdog would get $120 back. That's going to, you know, if there are even number of people bet on the whole thing, that all works out the same for the house. But that's not how the house sets it up. The house sets it up to embed some winnings for them so that if I bet $100 on the favorite, I'm going to get $75 back. And if I bet $100 on the underdog, I'm going to get $115 back. You see what I'm doing? So that's the odds that are set up here, either in odds like 3-1 to win or, you know, a point spreads to win. However you set it up, there is embedded in there an advantage for the house on every bet you take. That's how it's set up. And the government regulates how much of an edge you can take in there. In the same way the government regulates how much of a lottery payout there is. Now, parlays, it's not just one bet. It's multiple bets, each of which has an embedded advantage for the house. That's why the house loves you to take parlay bets. Because it's stringing together multiple bets, each of which have a little advantage for the house. So that's why they love parlays. That's how gambling works. It's not that you can be smarter than the house. It's that you have to be smarter than the root bet by a margin that's above the embedded margin that the house gets in it. Sorry, that was long-winded, but I hope that helps.
No, that was great, because these things can be very complicated, you know, to understand, unless you work through them like at a detailed level like that. When I was thinking about this is like a really eye-opening tweet for me, but I was thinking there's really three levels to this whole thing. You know, one is obviously that the system is unfair to this generation. The second is that that gambling is potentially a way out of that situation. And the third is, like, does a large portion actually believe that gambling is a way out? So the first is kind of, is gambling a way out? And the second is, do a large portion actually believe? And I thought maybe it was a good way to look at this and maybe to take those three things and break them apart. So, you know, the first one, to me, it seems like the arguments are pretty strong that this generation is a step behind. Like they have been handed an unfair hand relative to other generations. You know, Travis pointed out in the piece, he pointed out like home prices to income is something people show all the time. Wealth inequality, you can show stats around that. There's a lot of stats that could show that this generation, you know, relative to our older generations, does have a leg behind. I mean, do you think that's right, Ben?
I think this generation has both advantages and disadvantages, right? I think when it comes to wealth, I think the starting point is difficult for this generation for assets. I think there are other aspects though, particularly around opportunity, particularly around well, opportunity, very broadly speaking, where this generation, the younger generation, has enormous advantages over the boomers. So I don't think it's as simple as, oh, this generation got dealt a raw hand. I do think that when it comes to embedded wealth and the way that we have a system that is geared to preserve embedded wealth, I think that's a disadvantage, distinct disadvantage. I think there's one other disadvantage, and that is that we have an economy that has been built around scale. And what that means is that I think this is the you know, on my, when I say there's greater opportunity, where I think there's much less opportunity is in business formation. I think there's also a lot less opportunity around labor mobility. This, I mean, look, the engine of the United States, the economic engine, has been built on two things. One is population growth, immigration. And that, frankly, remains the advantage the United States has over every other country I can think of. You know, well, you know, the developed country I can think of. I mean, our population is still growing. And that's so important. And it's growing because of immigration. So leaving that aside, the other big advantage that our country's always had is just its size. And that if things weren't working out for you, you move. Labor mobility, $10 phrase for you move. You go to where there's work or there's land or there's opportunity. I think that labor mobility has really been cut down in the United States for this generation. I also think that the triumph of scale in our economic world also is a real disadvantage for entrepreneurialism and starting a company. So anyway, mixed bag. But yeah, when it comes to, it's harder than ever to buy a house unless you've got rich parents, then absolutely. That was always true, but now it's even more true.
How about this idea that gambling is the way out of this? I mean, the one thing I was thinking, like, as a challenge to this when I was reading this, is I couldn't believe that actually, like, a large portion of the generation would believe that the only way out of this is gambling. I mean, I could definitely understand around the edges people would think that, but I mean, do you think that's really like a popular belief among the generation that gambling is my only way, or these more aggressive bets, whether it be Bitcoin or whatever it is, that's my way out of this?
Yeah. So here's what the part of this kind of makes me angry, which is that luck is always a way out. And that's what everything we're talking about here, whether it's shit coins, whether it's options trading on Robinhood, whether it's parlay bets on FanDuel or something, this is all luck and variance. And maybe you'll be lucky and maybe you won't. But maybe you'll be lucky. What makes me angry is that we have a large industry that's geared towards telling people that it's not luck, but that there is actually skill, there is actually alpha that you can have in your day trading GameStop options or your bags of shit coins or your gambling on the NBA tonight. That's what makes me angry. Because there ain't, you do not have alpha. You don't. You do not. And all these people are telling you, well, let me read to you, you know, your talking points about why Bitcoin goes to 100,000. And look, Bitcoin might go to 100,000. It very well might. I'm not saying it won't. What I'm saying is that you think you've got some edge, that you think, oh, this is why? And why this coin does this? Or this is great. Give me a freaking break. You think you've got some edge in picking, I don't know, you know, NFL spreads? You don't. You do not. You are told that you do. And that is a lie. That's just a lie. And that's what makes me angry.
Market-based edges versus house-based edges. And correct me if I'm using those terms wrong. Either of you, Jack, I know you think about this a ton too.
So today, so what I mean is that buy and hold in the markets works because buying a stock is not a zero sum game. Buying a stock, fractional share of the cash flows of company X, there is a real world thing that is happening that over time has a positive expected value for you owning that fractional share. That's not a derivative, right? A derivative is a bet. A derivative is where you've got a winner and a loser. That is a derivative is a zero-sum game. It's a zero-sum game. And what zero-sum game means is that there is no intrinsic beta. There is no intrinsic risk premium. I'm using all these phrases, but you get what I mean. There's nothing real there. What there is you got a winner and you got a loser. And if you think you've consistently got an edge where you're consistently going to be the winner in a system where just winning 50.1% of your bets doesn't make you a winner. You've got to be 50% plus the VIG, the spread that the house gets on every bet. You do not have that alpha, right? You don't. You don't. And yeah, that is what makes me mad.
When I read this, like, it made me understand GameStop more. Like, I understood the behind the scenes, like, mechanism that led to GameStop, but it made me understand why so many people were still, you know, when the implied volatility of these options was so high, you know, when you right. were never going to make a profit, like, people were still buying it. And it also made me understand the anger at Robinhood, because if I think gambling is my only way out, and I think there's this group of people who have taken advantage of me, and Robinhood stops trading in GameStop, and I was about to make all this more money, I can understand why I would be really angry. So it kind of gave me that perspective for the first time of thinking about this from people who feel this way.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. I get it, particularly if that company is telling you that their mission is to democratize markets. Which is what Robinhood says, right? That is their mission, to democratize markets. Now, their mission is to get as big a spread, as much VIG as they can on these derivative bets. That's their mission. And it's the mendacity. I mean, look, I love to gamble. Guys, I am a degen from way back when. And when I say that my life would have been really different if online gambling had existed when I was in college, I mean it. I don't know about better, like been better, been worse, but it would have been different. It would have been a lot different. So this is no anti-gambling thing. It's not at all. If you want to be honest about being a gambler, if you want to be honest about being a casino and a house, do it. I am so in favor of that. But don't give me this crap about, oh, we're democratizing markets. Because that's what it is. It's just a load of crap. It's a load of self-serving crap. And that is what makes me angry. Sorry.
It makes me think of all the stuff Howard Lindzen's been writing. And I think this this thread in particular, Dimitri's language and Travis's language around this, really helped me understand that degenerate economy theme.
Yeah.
In a way that this is encompassing.
Well, and I do think we need to bring it back to our discussion the other week about these devices, because what we're talking about with gambling and the way that I fool myself into thinking that I'm good at poker, for example. And I'm fine at poker in a zero-sum situation where I'm playing with people who are not very good. I'm fine. I will make money consistent on that. But if you put me in a halfway decent game, I mean, I'm going to lose. I'm going to lose.
Is that your poker face?
No. It's why being a professional trader in markets, the ones who are good at it are very humble and recognize the role of luck and variance in everything they do. Having edge, having alpha in markets is so rare and so difficult. And that's among the smartest people in the world. And they are, because that's where the most money is, right? It's what attracts smart people. And edge is minuscule, edge is fleeting, and edge can be swamped by variance at any point in time. And now magnify that 10x, 20x for sports betting, card gambling, any of these gambling issues, multiply that, weekly options on freaking GameStop or whatever coin you're trading. It's the rush. The hardest thing about being a discretionary manager of money is that you convince yourself that it's the job to be looking at your Bloomberg Anywhere screen on your little phone all the time. You convince yourself that's your job. You have to do. And the truth is, it's not your job, and it doesn't make a difference. You'll actually overtrade if you stare at it. But I still do, or I still did. This is why I don't manage discretionary money anymore. I'll never do it again, because it kills you. It absolutely kills you. So I've got Twitter, whatever Twitter is today, Bloomberg back in the day, my little BlackBerry and stuff, it was 10 times worse, 10 times worse. And it kills you. It ages you in dog years. It kills you. And that's what so many young men, and they're all men and they're all young, that's what they're all doing to themselves right now. And that's not grumpy grandpa. I'm saying it's one of you. I'm saying that is one of you. It will kill you.
Well, speaking of death by Twitter, we've got a tweet of the week. Jack, reasons for treasons. What's Twitter telling us these days?
I think this is our first ever triple tweet of the week.
Triple.
We've got three layers here to this whole thing.
The triple parlay death tweet. Here
right.
We go.
Yeah, right? Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Hopefully our odds are a little better than the triple parlay here, but... starting all the way at the bottom, we have Colin Rugg, who I don't know who that is, but he was eventually retweeted by Elon Musk. But he had said, report, Joe Biden has secretly flown 320,000 illegal immigrants from Latin America airports to 43 U.S. cities, and he said treason.
Treason! So
before I even get into the
I think it was, wasn't it all caps treason?
It was not all caps, but it was treason. Okay. So I think treason is bad enough whether they have the caps or not. Yeah. But before I even get into the next tweet, I want to ask you, to be honest, this is probably lack of knowledge on my part, but I don't even know if this is true. Did Joe Biden actually fly illegal immigrants into...
No.
Is there any truth to this?
Is there any truth to it? So
I mean, I assume it's not true, literally. I'm sure this is exaggerated.
It is certainly not
the question
true
is there any truth to any of this?
So there is a long-standing, and by lad, I mean like 40-year-old program where we give asylum to. So there's, you're in Cuba, and you say, you make your way to the United States, and you say, applying for political asylum. Now, the whole asylum thing has been both expanded way too much, and instead of being, I'll call it, adjudicated on a case-by-case basis, has now been done in mass, right? And I think that's bad. And I would like for them to reverse that policy. But that is a policy, and so this has been around for a long time. Now, the new twist is, I'm in Venezuela, and I'm able to, one of the countries that we routinely give asylum to people coming out of Venezuela, coming to the United States. I'm able to book a flight into the United States. I'm actually able to go on my app now and say, hey, I'm flying into the United States and I'm applying for asylum. This becomes Joe Biden is flying in these illegal aliens under this program. Now, like I say, I think this is a bad policy. I really do. I think the way that we've dramatically expanded the asylum process, it undermines our existing process for immigration, which, by the way, I think should be expanded dramatically. And it's, I think it should be done on a case-by-case basis. And if you can't handle this sort of flow, then no, the answer is no. Right. Or, you know, you end up in, sorry, you're going to have to spend the next 3 years in a rather uncomfortable position, right, before we get to adjudication of your asylum claim. But asylum shouldn't just be, hey, I live in country X. I want to move to the United States. And I don't want to go through the immigration procedures. Ooh, give me asylum. But it's not treason.
Well, also what's crazy about it is someone who just reads this tweet and doesn't hear like an explanation like you just gave is going to think we're sending like military transport planes over there and just in mass, like bringing people across the border. Like,
and thinking that, by the way, Colin Rugg is one of these guys like Jackson Hinkle and these other guys. They're just, you know, they're professional stooges and, you know, they're doing this for that very reason. And in fact, the graphics are like, you know, military planes picking up people and then bringing them in. And then that gets to, you know, the second or third richest man in the world. I think this would be tweet number two.
Tweet number two, correct. So treason indeed. Ushering in vast numbers of illegals is why Secretary Mayorkas was impeached by the House. They are importing voters. This is why groups on the far left fight so hard to stop voter ID requirements under the absurd guise of protecting the right to vote. And just before I let you answer, I do want to read the definition of treason because I pulled it out of dictionary.com just to make sure we had it. It is the offense of attempting to overthrow the government of one's country or of assisting its enemies in war, specifically the act of levying war against the United States or adhering to or giving aid and comfort to its enemies by one who owes its allegiance.
Yeah.
So now I'll let you comment on Elon Musk.
No, I mean, you can make a lot better argument on the whole treason thing about the other guy. A lot better argument. And look, do I think that Joe Biden is a weak, ineffectual president? Yes, I do. Is he a traitor to the United States of America? Give me a fucking break. And here's why it matters. Well, maybe I'll let you get to tweet number three first. Get to tweet number three first.
Tweet number three is yours, so...
The parlay.
So your response was treason and tyranny, not language from the fringe, but from one of the richest men in the world and from the U.S. editor of the Financial Times.
Do the editor of the Financial Times.
Ed, I don't know if I have that one. I may have to. Yeah, I don't think I have that one.
Oh, I can tell you what it is, because what I did was I took two screenshots. One was a screenshot of Musk's treason indeed tweet. And the other was from Ed Luce, who is the U.S. editor for the FT, the Financial Times, right? One of the most respected, influential newspaper, important newspapers in the world. And what the U.S. editor of this newspaper, he writes an article, it's the tyranny of the Supreme Court. And reacting to the 9-0, the unanimous Supreme Court decision that, yes, in fact, Trump can be on the ballot. The 14th Amendment, through a state interpretation, does not Trump from prevent cannot prevent Trump from being on the ballot of Colorado. And Ed Luce is writing these 9 Supreme Court justices. The Supreme Court is an illegitimate institution. It is a tyrannical institution. He doesn't mean like soft tyranny of the majority or something like that. No, he literally means this is a tyrant. And that's what I'm reacting to in my tweet, Jack, that we've got words like traitor and tyrant not coming from fringe lunatics like Colin Effin Rugg or whoever, the Jackson Hinkles of the world, the Russian stooges of the world, but from, I don't know, second or third richest man in the world, from the U.S. editor of one of those influential newspapers in the world, saying the Supreme Court, because you don't like their decision, is a tyrant and needs to be, disbanded and overthrown. Or that because you don't like, and I don't like it either, the asylum policy of the United States, this is treason. It's LARPing is what it is, Jack. I think that's how it ended the tweet. And if you want to know why we're left with this choice, this abysmal choice of Trump and Biden as presidential candidates, the only presidential candidates we can vote for, it's because of, I think my phrase was LARPing dipshits. I think that's the exact phrase I use, like Musk and Luce. The weaponization of language, and by the way, this is a driver, I believe, of financial nihilism as well, is that you've got the Balaji's of the world, the Musks of the world, tweeting and writing about how, sorry, young guy in America, you're so screwed, and you're so screwed because of either the Democrats, the regime, or because of the Fed, or because of, on the other side, they'll tell you it's because of, Trump. You're screwed. You can't get ahead because of boomers and the Republicans. That Fred Mike Green talks about it. This is being fatalistic nihilism, right? The nihilism here is because you've been told you're screwed, and so thus your only chance is to YOLO it with something where you are told you've got some edge where you also don't.
And the scary part about this is people in you talked about the weaponization of words, like people in these kind of positions of power. I mean, these might not be elected leaders, but these are people in very strong positions of power with a lot of people who follow them. And they're using words like treason, in a context you shouldn't be using them. I mean, they're not worrying about at all about the consequences of their use of these words. They're just kind of throwing them out there.
Right. And I'll tell you what the consequences of the words are. The consequences of the words are like the guy in Pennsylvania who beheads his own father because he works, for the Army Corps of Engineers and is part of the regime. The Biden regime. The consequences of these words are like the Aaron Bushnell, I think his name was, who, lights himself on fire to protest God.
This is actual nihilism. That's the consequence of this.
Actually,
nihilistic behavior.
actual numbers by crazy people.
By crazy people. Because
there are a lot of crazy people out there.
And there's a lot of crazy.
And you know, even those who aren't so crazy, we get impacted by these words. I mean, how many people do you know who, I know a ton, who have gone off, you know, past the event horizon and into the black hole of Trumpiness or the black hole of wokeness? I've got friends, I've got family that have just, they're gone. They're gone in that world of words and that belief system. And it's just so wrong.
So on a more positive note, we're going to end on a huge positive note this time. Matt, you had another great piece on Cultish Creative, and I would recommend anybody who doesn't read Matt's blog at Cultish Creative do it. And it's really cool that I'm seeing,
amen,
like on Twitter, I'm seeing more and more sharing of your stuff, and it's great that people are finding this because it's so good. And like, I hope more and more people will keep reading it. But you had a great post about We Are the World, the creation of that song, what went on behind the scenes, what's going on with this new documentary. So can you just talk a little about what you had there?
I'm going to do a quick relay of this story, and thank you for those kind words. But if you haven't watched, and I guess tell me this, have either of you or both of you seen this documentary yet on Netflix?
Not
yet.
Okay.
Nope.
I'm going to, though.
I see the disapproval in your eyes there, Matt. Oh, man.
No, it's not even the disapproval. I'm so excited.
We need to do our prep work
for this. I'm so excited for you to watch this and to get an email or a text or whatever it is that just says like, yep, just, yep, it's that good. So I've been fascinated with the story of, it's called The Greatest Night in Pop. I've been fascinated by this for years. There's always been snippets on YouTube and other places because it's this idea that on a single night after the American Music Awards in 1985, so starting at something like 11 o'clock at night, all of the greatest pop stars, or almost all of the greatest pop stars in American music, go to one recording studio, all stand in a room together, shoulder to shoulder, and record a song for charity. No one's compensated on this. I'm sure the house made some money to print the tapes and sell the records. But this happens between the hours of 11-ish p.m. at night after an award show when all these people were in town and like 7 or 8 o'clock the next morning. One of the biggest hits of 1985 gets recorded with all these people in a room that you could never, there's no way to pull this off. And this is before cell phones. This is before email. This is before all this stuff. That's a lot of big favor cards that get pulled. And in this piece, so that's this, you have to see it because they taped the whole thing. They shot this music video that I've been watching since I was a kid, but because they were shooting this music video, they have all the behind the scenes footage of this whole thing coming together. And Lionel Richie is there to curate this whole thing for you in the documentary. So one part really, really blew my mind. And this was in the Cultish Creative post the other day. I called it Perform in Front of Your Peers. It's a lot for us to talk about on this here. So if you're going to have 40 plus mega pop superstars, I'm talking Michael Jackson, Bob Dylan, Cyndi Lauper, Stevie Wonder, they're all coming into this room. Huey Lewis. You're going to have some egos. And Quincy Jones, producing it, famously puts on the door before they walk in, like, check your ego at the door or something to that effect.
I'm just glad you put Huey Lewis and Bob Dylan there in the same sentence there. I love that. That's perfect. That's great.
Sports was my first record. We go back, me and Huey. So they get into this thing. And so Lionel Richie is coordinating this whole thing. And they get into this. They're getting ready to get them all into the room. And Lionel basically says to Quincy Jones, the acting and very famous producer, like, okay, so when we get to the solo section, will we send everybody into the vocal booth to record their spot? Michael Jackson will go in, record his. He'll walk out. Then, you know, Bob Dylan will walk in and do his and then walk out and blah, blah, blah. And Quincy says, absolutely not. Everybody is going to sing every single part in this room in front of everybody else. And there's going to be no entourage. There's going to be no managers. There's going to be no fans. It's going to be all these artists staring at each other with microphones in front of their face. And it worked. Why do you think it worked, Ben? What do you know about this stuff? It's not the recording music. What is happening in their heads?
It is the crowd watching the crowd, man. It is that once you see, and it works in so many ways, right? There's so many, like you say, folds and permutations. This, if they had sent everybody off individually, as you're saying, Matt, it would never have happened. People had wandered off. I'm not on for another hour. It's already whatever it is, 2 a.m. I'm out of here, man.
They had people walk out. Waylon Jennings walks out of the session halfway through because, what am I doing?
Right. So, but by doing it there where you're, I think the point you made, Matt, which is that you're performing in front of your peers, right? And there's absolutely that. My focus is on the peers looking at the crowd of peers watching the guy perform or the gal perform. That's the crazy bit, right? Because you stick around and you're into it and you're hoping you get a chance to belt it out and you become part of the crowd. That's the thing. Being part of a crowd, brain is so hardwired to respond to that. I don't care if you're Bob Dylan or you're, a schmo like us, right? You respond to that. This created the what Q did was he created, you are part of this crowd. And that is the most motivating thing in social history. It's incredible. So smart.
Completely brilliant strategy, completely brilliant execution. And I want to ask you another thing, because it's kind of like the game theory of setting this up this way.
Yeah.
There's these competing like leaders and narratives that keep trying to emerge. So when the crowd watches the crowd, funny stuff happens. Like different people assume a completely like hands-off role. Like Dan Aykroyd is there. Dan Aykroyd's not a singer, but he's a celebrity of 1985. Right. And he's there in all his mulleted, glasses-ed up glory, just standing there hanging out and singing along and We Are the World. But there's this thing that happens, like different people have different ideas. They try to push stuff up. And we watch the crowd and we watch these stories like emerge and recess. What's happening when we're seeing that? Why does that happen?
We talk about, the missionary, right? So the way the whole common knowledge game works is there a missionary, meaning someone who can kind of stand up with a microphone, and it doesn't have to be a statement. It can also be a way of interpreting, and it's not look at me. It's about, can I channel something that's believed in common by the people there? So it matters a lot who Q schedules up first, right? To set the tone of the performance. Because if you put up there some prima donna, and they're all prima donna, right? There are a lot of egos in that room, as you're saying, but it's more than just, am I expressing an ego? Am I able to tap into, or conversely, am I able to take the crowd in a different direction from what Q wanted them to achieve there? So I'm sure there was, anyway, however he scheduled it, it was brilliant because the ordering matters as well.
Do you know what it was, Matt?
Ordering of the performance matters a lot.
Do you know what the ordering was?
I'll give you guys a spoiler on that in a second, but one of the most profound things about that you're helping clarify in my head right now as I hear it is, so Bob Geldof, who's a famous activist, so he's...
It was really kind of the organizer, right? I mean, the whole... Was he? So you go on. You tell me.
No. So this is part of what's amazing is Geldof. I'm telling two stories a little bit out of order here. Geldof had done Live Aid previously.
Right.
And so the idea with Live Aid is, with this, it proved that something like this could happen. And that's a really cool thing that this can even happen in the first place. But what ends up happening like behind the scenes, and what was the, I'm trying to figure out what the other song, Do They Know It's Christmas That was the other one. That was the huge one from before. That was the Bob Geldof one and then Band-Aid and everything else. So Harry Belafonte, daylight come and we want to go home. Harry Belafonte basically says, this is great, but where are the people of African descent who want to help out the Africans? Why are they not showing up? Why do we not have a movement? Why is this Bob Geldof's movement? Nothing against Bob Geldof. I respect what he's doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember when that came up. Yeah, yeah.
So Harry Belafonte is actually the one who reaches out to one of the main talent agencies and people that he knows inside of Hollywood and the music industry and the crossover. They figure out how to get Bob Geldof involved. And this is the initial call, is Harry Belafonte basically saying, like, Quincy Jones, and ultimately then Quincy saying Lionel Richie, we need to do this thing for our people. Because if Harry Belafonte doesn't reach down to that next generation to get them involved, which Lionel Richie is intimately aware of, this is what's happening. Here is the elder statesman saying, you are being tapped to do something. I think we can do something. Are you going to show up?
Fascinating. Amazing.
Utterly
fascinating. I can't wait to see the documentary now. This is really cool.
I got to tell you about one other person. I'm working on another post for this because this was like a second watch thing. Where you watch the thing and then you're scratching your head and you're like, did all those things actually happen? So I think you'll love this because I think this is very in the spirit of Epsilon Theory and of the stuff we talk about on Breaking News. I got to tell you about Stevie Wonder, who I have decided is the ultimate team player in anything. There's a crazy through line when you watch this that I want you to watch for. So after the Harry Belafonte thing and they get Quincy Jones, and Quincy Jones basically says, Lionel, you're going to write this song and you're going to write this song with Stevie Wonder. Now, here's a little thing you probably don't know about Stevie Wonder. When you call Stevie Wonder, at least in the mid 80s, he doesn't always answer the phone and it's a landline. So who knows? But so they're like, he's on Stevie time. So you would think if Quincy Jones and Lionel Richie are calling you, hopefully you check the messages and you call
them. Hopefully, hopefully you check your message machine. Yeah.
Stevie doesn't call. So Quincy, you're Quincy Jones for a second, Jack. You scratch your head. Well, if Stevie's not going to do it, who do you call on that Rolodex?
After Stevie Wonder?
After Stevie Wonder. Who's your next call?
I don't know. I'm not sure where I would go after that.
Well, this is fun. You call your old friend Michael Jackson. Because what's he doing?
So basically you can call anyone you want if you're him.
Because you're Quincy Jones.
Yeah, you can go right at the top, right?
So Quincy Jones calls Lionel Richie, then says, well, we couldn't get Stevie, so you and Michael are going to write this song together. It's going to be huge. We're going to do this whole thing, expense thing, whatever else. Stevie never returns the call, so Lionel and Michael write the song. It's a wonderful story. It involves all of Michael Jackson's animals. Lionel Richie does an incredible Michael Jackson impression. That's worth watching this for alone. So they're on the day where now it's like, a week from recording, and they're doing the first demo because they have to send tapes out to all the people who are going to show up for this thing to convince them to show up in the first place. And Stevie Wonder walks into the studio and he's like, hey, I'm here to write the song. And it's like, so Quincy has to be like, song's already written. We actually need to get this done because we need to send like 60 tapes out with these copied letters, physical mail. I can't email you the thing. So Stevie just in the moment is like, cool. He sings on the demo with them.
Like, get out. What a man.
That's the first thing he does that is mind-blowing after missing the call. So he does the demo. He steps back. Now, the night of the session, and there is a whole wonderful thing about the producer who helps come in and helps Quincy Jones figure out who sings each line. I'm not going to give that away. You got to watch it. It's literally, it's a work of art. It's just utterly fantastic. So the night of the session, they're all in the room and Stevie decides halfway through that if they're singing for Africans, they should sing some of the lyrics in an African language. He apparently knows some Swahili. Spoiler, this is when Waylon Jennings mutters something about good old boys don't sing in Swahili. He exits the room, but there's this whole thing. So remember when I said this is that thin moment of balance where the whole thing can just fall apart with these egos?
Yep.
So here's Stevie Wonder like pitching in Swahili and Cyndi Lauper's like, how do I pronounce that? And Al Jarreau's like, oh, wouldn't you mean like this? But not everybody in Africa speaks Swahili. Is this a good thing? And it just like, it's about to come apart at the seams. And Quincy grabs Bob Geldof again, and this is when Geldof makes the point of, we're not singing to the Africans, we're singing to the English speakers who have money, who can help the Africans. How's that for a missionary point, Ben?
Love that. So smart.
Ray Charles yells, ring the bell, Quincy, to get them all back into action. I think in this moment, it's fantastic. But again, Stevie just totally backs off. He's totally convinced an idea. He tries to take the room in a direction, and then he totally backs off when the room is like, maybe this isn't the right idea. Later, there's a background vocal that Michael Jackson improvises that they all sing, and it's basically a ethnic sounding piece of gibberish, but it's effectively in tribute to Stevie's idea, and it's another just wacky thing that happens. Now, the most incredible team player thing that Stevie does, and two other really funny little things that Stevie does that aren't the most incredible thing, but are credible. At one point, he sits down next to Ray Charles, and Ray Charles says, I have to go to the bathroom. And Stevie goes, oh, I'll show you. And he picks him up, and they go walking to the bathroom, and somebody yells out, the blind are leading the blind, and it kills. The whole room falls apart. That's awesome. There's another part right before Harry Belafonte leaves, when Al Jarreau starts singing the Banana Boat song, Daylight Come and We Want to Go Home. And Stevie starts improvising lyrics, and he's talking about how, I think Al Jarreau is drunk, and he basically says, like, if you drink too much, you'll be driven home by me and Ray. Again, slays, whole room is doubled over. Cool. So good. So the thing that he does that just, like, tears in my eyes watching this, Bob Dylan's turn. I'll give you a shot at this. Does Bob Dylan have a beautiful singing voice?
No, he does not.
Do you put Bob Dylan and Huey Lewis in the same vocal range? Steve Perry from Journey? Do you see Bob Dylan? And like, this guy is deer in headlights, mortified for this whole, every camera. They have so many great close-up camera cuts of him just looking like he wants to puke on his shoes. It's devastating. And so we get to this part where Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan are going to do these ad-libbed over-the-top like chorus vocals. And Bruce, you can imagine.
Bruce, I remember this. I can remember it now. I mean, Bruce lays into it. He does. Yeah.
Glass in his throat, Bruce lays into it.
Yeah.
Coming off.
Yeah.
Coming off the Born to Run tour. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan, though, is just not that guy. So like, there's this amazing scene and Bob Dylan's holding these mouse hands, holding this shaking score. And they play it back and he just kind of mumbles and looks terrified and like,
yeah.
And it's another one where you're like, this thing's going to fall apart. Like they're two solos away from the end and this thing's going to fall apart. And he's like, Stevie, like, can you help me with this? Can we run some ideas? So Stevie comes in and sits down at the piano. And this is something I didn't know this. Apparently Stevie Wonder is one of the world's greatest mimics. So Stevie sits at a piano with Bob Dylan over his shoulder, starts playing We Are the World and the part that Dylan's going to solo over. When you watch this, you have to watch Bob Dylan's mouth not moving because Bob Dylan is watching Stevie Wonder do the most impeccable Bob Dylan impression
you've ever heard.
Oh, and he teaches him. He teaches him to how to be Bob Dylan on the song.
That's crazy. That's a great story.
It might be like one of the most magical team player moments ever. Like, so Stevie plays, he does a solo in the, like he's the first line, him and Lionel start the whole thing off, but he's not a feature in any way. And he elevates the work of this entire group over and over and over again. Even when he's wrong, he is the ultimate team player. It is one of the most magical things I've ever seen in my life. Please, please go watch this movie.
Sold.
I just have to say, man, I'm gonna definitely watch this tonight after hearing you, but I wish I knew someone at Netflix and they could do a cut with Matt Ziegler talking over it, like as the director or something as this whole thing goes on, because it would probably be even better than the actual thing. Like,
I'll do the director's cut, Netflix, if you're listening.
Well, if anybody's watching from Netflix, you know, give Matt a call.
I'm available. I've got a summary for us. And man, despite a lightning round issue, I got some good quotes here and comments. So in the first section today, we talked about financial nihilism. I wrote down this, I don't know if you know this Camus quote, but in the end, one needs more courage to live than to kill yourself. That's dark, such as nihilism, such as existentialism. And I like to think of this as our breaking news sentiment. But in the end, one needs more optimism. And that's in terms of social and financial profits to live for than to self-destruct our entire system over. Because we humans, we should not rather or prefer to gamble than invest in something just because it doesn't scale. I think financial nihilism, that long-term ramification of using that to hide from investing things that maybe don't scale but mean something is really, really important.
Agreed.
We talked about these tweets and what I wrote down. This is financial media nihilism. That's what this is. It's you say crazy stuff to get crazy eyeballs and ad revenues, I guess. But this pro-LARPers, what they're doing is they're gambling with humanity. And that is why these are so important and connected, because they are driving financial nihilistic behavior. And that is sick. And we deserve to call this stuff out when we see it. Talking about the special, Ben, you mentioned how the crowd watches the crowd. And this idea that the team playing has to be respecting the others they're watching, that's the part with financial media nihilism. That's the part with financial nihilism that we see that's missing. There's not a mutual respect for what this is or where this is going or what this means. That's the sad part. That's the degenerate part, is it's okay to have fun, but it's not okay to not think about how this plays forward and where those dollars or things might actually be spent. And I truly mean invested as opposed to expensed. The last point I want to make, and this is channeling Stevie Wonder here, is being a team player ultimately means seeing the smallest thing worth investing in, seeing Bob Dylan and seeing him need help, knowing your idea is going to get rejected. And instead of just gambling it away and walking out of the room with no social good, we have to believe this is the ultimate message. We are the world. There is a place for you and me. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Matt. That was great.
Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to like and subscribe wherever you're watching Breaking News so more people can find our show. If you know another clear-eyed and full-hearted individual, why not share this episode with them too? Like we said at the top, the media is making us tick, and it's our job to talk. Follow the headlines at fiatnews.com. Follow Ben at epsilontheory.com and at epsilontheory on Twitter. Follow Jack at validiacapital.com and at Practical Quant on Twitter. Follow Matt at sunpointinvestments.com, cultishcreative.com, and at cultishcreative on Twitter.